Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the latest episode of Close Readings. This series we've called The Long and Short because in it we're looking at a selection of modern long poems and short stories. Modern meaning in this case from about the middle of the 19th century onwards. And as always, our conversation is informed by the immense archive of essays and reviews and other things that make up the back catalogue of the London Review of Books. My name is Seamus Perry. I'm a tutor in English at Balliol College in Oxford, and I'm talking to Mark Ford, poet, critic, and professor of English literature at University College London. And today, I'm sorry to say, we've reached the final instalment of this particular run, and our subject is the short stories of Elizabeth Bowen. So, Mark, these short stories are the most recent that we've looked at, and I suppose we can find all sorts of ways in which they're drawing on the short stories that we've considered before, stories by James and stories by Mansfield, but perhaps especially Joyce.
Yes, the connections with particularly the dead and stories such as Mysterious Core are particularly worth considering. Bowen was Anglo-Irish. Her family had actually moved over back in the 17th century when sort of Cromwell invaded Ireland, and her ancestry sort of dates back over centuries, but she did spend most of her life, she grew up in Kent rather than in Ireland, but she had this big house called Bowen's Court that eventually she had to sell in the 1950s. But in some ways, she's very interestingly divided between Ireland and England, particularly the south coast of England. Many of the stories take place on the south coast of England, but others take place in Ireland. And I think what's interesting in terms of her Anglo-Irish ancestry in relation to certainly two or three of the stories we're going to be talking about is the way they slide into a kind of melodramatic gothic excess that reminds one of Dracula or Sheridan Le Fanu, a sense in which something rather supernatural or grotesque or impossible to make sense of, some kind of threat is being enacted, which is quite characteristic of writing in that tradition.
Yes, it's an importantly different kind of Irishness, isn't it? And Bowen herself talks about the phenomenon of Anglo-Irishness quite a lot in her interviews and essays and things like that. And she always characterises it as a state where you aren't really quite one thing nor another, or you're Irish when you want to be, but you're English when you're not being Irish. So in that sense, it's very different from Joyce, isn't it, for whom Irishness, at least as it's represented in Dubliners, is a sort of condition which you cannot escape, really. It's something that kind of saturates you.
That's true. I think what they share is that, especially in those early stories, but in Portrait as well, Portrait of the Artist, the Young Man, is that astonishingly dispassionate perspective on experience that there you find in both Dubliners and Bowen's short stories. Really acute social realism that she's both obviously are famous for their novels as well as their stories. But in the stories, which are quite different from Bowen's novels, in that the characters, she liked to say, they didn't develop in her stories, but she captures an atmosphere, an environment, a place, a kind of social condition almost, with utter acuteness and real sort of detail, which is completely convincing. So each of these stories is really sort of saturated in recognisable milieu.
So let's start with the first of the stories that we said we were going to be talking about. And this is quite an early story called The Parrot. I think this is an amazing and wonderful, funny, sad story, which really, I think, shows its sort of Joycean credentials very clearly, but is at the same time doing something very different from Joyce. So it's all about, I'm sure our readers know, it's all about a parrot that escapes and the, in the end, successful attempts of Eleanor, the paid companion, to get it back and restore it to Mrs. Wilsdon, who is her boss, her employer. And Bowen uses this story, doesn't she, in a brilliantly understated way to explore Eleanor's own desire for escape and liberation into an alternative kind of life to the terribly confined and trapped and imprisoning life that she lives with Mrs. Wilsdon. So in that sense, it does feel a little bit like Eleanor feels a little bit like a Joyce character, like Lily from The Dead or Maria from Clay, maybe.
Yes, she's trapped in Mrs. Wilsdon's house, which is rather dull, dour. Mr. Wilsdon has been long dead. Mrs. Wilsdon is a not particularly sympathetic person to work with. The one thing she seems to be interested in or care about is her parrot.
She's very fond of her parrot.
And this parrot escapes early in the morning, and Eleanor Fitch and the parlourmaid Maud are described rushing out onto the lawn to try and catch this parrot, which then you see progress down the street. And it's okay if it would stay in the Philpott's house, because the Philpott are an acceptable family. But the last house on the road, which is not in London, by the way, it's outside London, somewhere in the suburbs, is owned by the Lennicotts. And the Lennicotts are clearly bohemians of some kind.
Yeah.
A fairly mild kind, as far as one can tell. But they are bohemians, and he writes books which are thought to be improper, but are possibly avant-garde rather than particularly kind of rude, in that Mrs. Wilsdon gets one from the library and is embarrassed to have to ask for it. And well, then when she gets it home, she can't get through it, because it's obviously quite kind of experimental. So that's where the parrot lands. So poor Eleanor has to go along the wall and jump down into the Lennicott's garden. And this is entering forbidden territory for this rather dreamy, very sympathetic characters, tremendous kind of pathos and poignance, particularly towards the end, because she's terrified of the Lennicotts, that somehow she thinks that this is, you know, dancing with the devil, so to speak.
Yes.
And in fact, they're rather kind, though, you know, eccentric in a perhaps slightly obvious way. He's wearing a dressing gown with dragons embroidered on it.
Absolutely.
And she's in the garden with her feet on a watering can, sort of relaxing early in the morning. But the actual interactions between the Lennicotts and Eleanor are very sort of touchingly done.
We've talked a little bit about its Joycean credentials. I suppose you could also see in it something that resembles Lawrence, in that there is a respectable veneer of nice civility and polite life, but actually underneath it is bubbling this fierce, rather kind of sexualized kind of life, which Bowen ironizes in a delightful and humorous way, but nevertheless, you know, still lets us feel that there is this slight kind of erotic or sexual charge. The sun streamed in and Mr. Lennicott's dragons glowed. I mean, Lawrence, that would be given to you straight.
Yes, it's true. There's a sentence, say, when she's describing the parrot, it wore an air of silly bravado and looked what it was, thoroughly idiotic. Now, Lawrence could have written that line.
Yes,
he's very,
yes,
very
yes.
good at capturing animals and somehow getting animals and presenting them as if they were people and had a kind of life of their own. And this parrot, we don't admire this parrot at all. It's not been given to Mrs. Wilsdon by a romantic pirate or anything like that. She bought it at an auction.
Yes.
And it doesn't say anything interesting, and it's annoying. And there's a sense in which it's new in some way, as if it's nouveau.
It's not standing for a principle of vitality. Really,
absolutely not.
Is it in this one? In fact, it's a knackered old parrot. Take me, it seemed to say. I am an old sick bird, beaten out and weary. I have aspired and failed. It is finished, which is what Christ says on the cross, after all. It is finished. Take me. There's something very, very funny about the way that she adopts this kind of Lorentzian evocation of a kind of subterranean, exciting animal life, and then, as I say, kind of sends it up at some level.
And in fact, I like the way in a couple of times she compares Eleanor to a cat. In fact, Mr. Lennicott says to Eleanor, young girl like you should be able to climb like a cat. And you get this sense of Eleanor's kind of physicality,
yes,
in that kind of metaphor. And you get this really vertiginous moment when she's up on the roof, because the parrot, she's about to catch the parrot, but she moves too fast and it jumps up onto the gutter of the Lennicott's house and then onto the roof, which means she has to enter the Lennicott's house, which is absolutely terror for Bowton, to mix my languages. She's in real peril, she thinks, of her moral state. And Mr. Lennicott climbs up onto the roof and seems to forget about the parrot.
Yes, yes, it has to be reminded why he's there. That's right.
And she climbs up after him. And when she looks down, she looks down on the street, and it's a kind of bird's eye view, which I think looks forward in some ways to the way the moon operates in Mysterious Core.
Yes.
This really high, impersonal view down, which is a beautiful perspective. I'll read the passage. It's a couple of pages from the end. He gripped both her hands and hoisted, that's Mr. Lennicott, hoisting Eleanor up onto the roof. He was sitting astride of the roof, and Eleanor sat side saddle, tucking down her skirts round her legs. White clouds had come up and bowled past before the wind like puffballs. The poplars swayed confidentially towards one another, then swayed apart in mirth. One of the Philpott girls was mending a bicycle down in their garden, but she did not look up. Her bowed back looked narrow and virginal. Amazing word, isn't it? Eleanor half laughed elatedly and smoothed her hair behind her ears.
Hmm.
I mean, the release that she's experiencing in this escape from the sort of claustrophobic gloom of Mrs. Wilson's house up there. And it's not an epiphany. It's just a momentary release or escape, but it's really exhilarating.
Yes, it's a momentary escape, isn't it? And it's going to come to an end. And it's important that by the end of the story, she's reincarcerated. Again, she's back in the world of Mrs. Wilson. And tells her a lie, says that she managed to get the parrot back on her own and didn't have to get anyone's help. And Mrs. Wilson's response to that is very striking, isn't it? She says, if strange people had caught him, even people quite respectable and honest, it would have put me in an embarrassing position, under compliment, I mean. I do very much dislike being under compliment, which is an Irishism, meaning, you know, to be obliged or obligated to someone. So you get a wonderful glimpse, don't you, of really quite a damaged psyche at the end there.
Thanks for listening to this extract from The Long and Short, a close reading series from the London Review of Books. To listen to the full episodes and all our other close reading series, sign up to our close reading subscription. Go to lrb.me/close readings or click on the link in the description.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.